From deep within Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk about the end of pensions for teachers in Michigan.
These defined benefit systems are just largely unaffordable.
Federal agents continue to pick up Christian and Shia Muslims to deport to Iraq.
The question is, how could you send these folks back into a fire?
The University of Michigan is going to offer free tuition to kids in the state when the family makes under $65,000 a year.
We talk a lot about diversity at the University of Michigan. One of the important forms of diversity on our campus is socioeconomic diversity.
And Cheers learns about a new cocktail at a Grand Rapids restaurant.
She really wanted to put like a cocktail that had vodka in it, and it was just pretty much against it. Fought her tooth and nail.
Guess what ingredient is in the lover's quarrel? Plus, we look at why insurance plans in Obamacare are going up again. But first, let's find out what in the world's happening now. Here's the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Federal immigration agents took more than 100 Iraqi nationals into custody with plans to deport most of them. We've heard about a number of Muslims being deported, but many of these Iraqis are Christian Chaldeans. Deporting them to Iraq means they could face persecution in that country. The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan has filed a class action lawsuit to stop the deportations, arguing that they should be given the opportunity to prove that they could face torture or death if returned to Iraq. Nathan Colasso is a Chaldean community advocate. He also founded Keys Grace Academy, a Chaldean-centered charter school in Madison Heights, and he joins us now. Most of these 114 or so people are being held at a detention facility in Youngstown, Ohio. You've been working with the ACLU in Ohio to get these Iraqi immigrants legal representation. How's that effort been going?
Well, just a couple things to clarify, that the number has been increasing ever since Sunday. There have been isolated or handful of raids that have been taking place throughout the week this week. At Keys Grace Academy, my sister had operated Code Legal Aid, which served as an advocacy and counseling organization to service low-income families. And so what we did was Sunday night, we put out a call to action and opened our doors at Keys Grace for families to come in, and we served as a clearinghouse for the ACLU. Since then, Code Legal Aid, the organization that my sister founded, has been listed as a co-counsel on the federal complaints. What we are doing right now is sort of acting as a triage center. Families come in, we obtain information, and we try to link them up to affordable attorneys, because although the ACLU has filed the complaint, we are still recommending that all families retain proper legal representation on an individual basis.
There's a large Chaldean community in Southeast Michigan. The Chaldean Catholic Bishop has called last weekend's roundup of immigrants a, quote, very strange and painful day for our community in America, end quote. What's been the reaction in the community to these detentions?
A lot of frustration and confusion. The confusion lies, I guess, if you will, because this community has suffered under several circumstances. For decades, we have been victims of genocide, stemming back to World War I during the Ottoman Turkish massacre of our people. And just as recent as March 2016, our people were declared victims of genocide by the Obama administration, reaffirmed by the current administration and by this Congress. So the confusion and frustration lies there. Although these folks may have criminal convictions, some of them range from 15 to 20 years ago, and they have maintained good status as residents in this country. They have built lives. They have started families. They're business owners. They're taxpayers, and they have rehabilitated themselves. And so the question is, how could you send these folks back into a fire?
You mentioned Congress. It's working on a bill to aid Christians and other minority religions in Iraq and Syria who have been targeted by Islamic State militants. In the meantime, this agency, ICE, is sending those very same kind of people back to Iraq. I'm wondering what you think of what seems to be a contradiction in goals by government officials.
That's what we're wondering, too. This is where the hypocrisy lies. And we've made broad efforts to appeal to whoever we can. There's been a congressional Democratic delegation letter that's been led by Congressman Levin. We are trying to make an appeal to the vice president's office. We have a conference call set up later for today to try to do something, to get something on his desk. So we're pursuing political efforts as well as legal efforts.
A spokesman for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says this rounding up of Iraqi nationals is, quote, routine, something that's done on a daily basis. And I got to think, I haven't heard of anything like this. How
that's
often in the past?
That's not true.
Yeah.
Simply not true. This was deliberate. First and foremost, it was done on a Sunday. That's a very important day in our community. Anyone who knows Southeast Michigan knows the Chaldean Assyrian community here. We were very proud. We wear our religion on our sleeve. And to utilize Sunday as a day in which immigration raids were conducted is vicious. It was deliberate. It was intentional. And we know exactly what this stems from. This stems from a sort of quid pro quo between the Iraqi government and the Trump administration to remove Iraq off of the travel ban list, the revised travel ban list. In exchange, Iraq would take back nationals who were under deportation status in the United States. If this was such a routine thing, then how come some of these folks who have had deportation notices for the last 25 years were not rounded up in the last 25 years?
You were quoted in Politico. You were mentioning a woman whose uncle was detained, and he was to be a bone marrow donor to her. Can you tell us about that?
He served as a bone marrow donor on two separate occasions. He saved her life. He had minor convictions in the 80s and 90s, nonviolent offenses, and he's at risk of being deported. Someone who has rehabilitated himself, who has set himself up, who has saved lives. She's an American. She was born here. He has saved an American's life on two separate occasions. I mean, these are some of the cases that we're dealing with. We're trying to put faces and stories on the surface because there is so much misinformation and misconceptions about these folks. These are not people who came here illegally. They came here legally. They may have fallen into some trouble. Okay, but they have rehabilitated themselves. They are taxpayers. They love this country. For some of them, they've been here since they were 6 months old. So we're trying to put stories on the surface level so that folks understand what we're dealing with.
Nathan Colosio founded the Keys Grace Academy, a Chaldean-centered charter school in Madison Heights. And we've been talking about the more than 100 Chaldeans who have been detained by federal agents and taken to Ohio. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for providing awareness on this matter and for this interview. Thank you so much.
The Knight Foundation's Cities Challenge Awards were announced recently. One of the projects it's funding is an urban beach along Detroit's riverfront. It will be another segment of the growing Detroit Riverfront Walkway put together by the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. Mark Wallace is the president and CEO there. Tell me, what exactly is an urban beach?
Well, urban beach is the beach that happens to be in a city instead of out in the country someplace. So we're very excited about this idea. But there's one more asterisk on this beach, which is you're not going to be able to get into the water, but you're still going to have that sand experience. You're still going to have the beach games. You're still going to have the beach feel. So you get the vibe of the beach, but your kids aren't going to get wet.
Right. It's going to be a little higher than the water is.
Exactly. Yeah, that water moves pretty fast in the Detroit River.
You're calling it the Atwater Beach. Where will it be located?
That's right. It's located at the foot of Joseph Campo. So if you know the Stroh's River Place, if you know the Talent Center, right across from Andrews on the river. So.
Actually, I think for those of us not really familiar with the area, how far east or upriver from the Renaissance Center is it?
Got it. Yeah, it's about halfway between the Renaissance Center and Belle Isle.
Oh, okay. I'm with you now. So how big is it going to be?
It's neat. It's several acres, so it's a relatively large piece of property. And what's cool about it is it really punctuates a series of park spaces on the riverfront. If you think of the Detroit River Walk as a series of parks, you've got, you know, the Great Heart Plaza, you've got the Great Fountain in front of Renaissance Center. At Rivard Streets, Rivard Plaza has bike rentals with Wheelhouse Detroit. It has a great place for boats to dock. It's got a great carousel. But then you have to go all the way down to Mount Elliott Street, where we built a water park 2 years ago. And in between the carousel and the water park is a big gap. And when we talk to the people of Detroit about what we're missing, they said they really wanted to see something for families and kids right at that location. And there happened to be a piece of property we could get to.
I want to ask you about some of the features. What's the music sensory garden?
That's going to be a really neat spot for kids. One of the things we've done at other places is had opportunities for kids to bang on things, make noise, sort of modified, souped-up instruments, whether it's percussion instruments or xylophones. So we're going to have some features that kids can play with and actually make music. And interact with each other in that way.
There's a River Lights installation which appears to be underwater and something called the Whiskey Town Barge. Tell us about that.
Whiskey Town. So at one point in time, this was a real center for rum running and whiskey. People would go across to Canada, and when it was frozen, they'd drive their cars across the ice, and when it wasn't, they'd take boats across. there's some neat old photos, sort of surveillance photos from Prohibition, which we've seen. So we thought we'd play up on that theme. We'll have a barge that connects two pieces of the project and creates a little bit of a harbor off of the edge of the river. And we're calling that the Whiskey Top Barge for now. But we expect to have some great Prohibition-themed beverages and some great food there as well.
There is a place called The Shed. What exactly is its function?
Yeah, so The Shed is an incubator space for other food and beverage, but also retailers in the city. There are a lot of people in Detroit who have great ideas, and they just need some space to get a toehold. So we've been very successful at getting a lot of people to come to the riverfront, and we're trying to provide more opportunities for those people to purchase food, beverage, and handmade items. And we're also trying to produce an opportunity for people with great ideas to encounter a big market. So it's a great intersection, and we're still working on that concept, but that should be a neat spot.
This night grant is $225,000. Is that enough to construct and landscape the whole thing, or is this just seed money?
Yes, that's a huge contribution, and we are so grateful to the Knight Foundation for supporting the idea and for putting us on the map with this contribution. We still have some fundraising left to do, but Knight Foundation has really been transformative in the city of Detroit for a long, long time. And recently with the challenges, the Arts Challenge and the City's Challenge, they're really doing a lot to stimulate new ideas and push our community to dream bigger. So we're very grateful for the Knight Foundation, and it's a huge contribution to us, and we're very excited about putting that into the ground.
I read an MLive article that the inspiration for Atwater Beach came from urban beaches in Toronto and Philadelphia, although this looks to be a little more extensive than those. How does it compare?
Yeah, it'll be about the same size as Sugar Beach in Toronto, but we're really hoping to make it feel like a specifically Detroit place. The designers we're working with are from Philadelphia and Groundswell, and they have good experience with this. But every time we talk to them, we say, how can we make this more Detroit? How can we make this more unique? We want this to be a place that people travel to, and we want it to be a place where local Detroit residents and Metro Detroit residents can feel proud that we have a one-of-a-kind thing here.
When will the Atwater Beach be completed and open to the public?
Yeah, our goal is to open up next year, and we're very excited about that. We've had some great conversations with funders, and certainly the support of the Knight Foundation has really kick-started this project, and we're excited about moving it forward.
Mark Wallace is president and CEO of Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. We've been talking about the new feature along the Riverwalk, which is going to be called Atwater Beach. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And we should say, in the interest of full disclosure, Michigan Radio is also a recipient of Knight Foundation grants. Stick around. We've got more for you. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The University of Michigan is launching something called the Go Blue Guarantee. Here to tell us what that is U of M President Mark Schlissel. So tell me about this free tuition program.
Sure. The idea, Lester, is for families, students from families that make at or below $65,000 a year, we guarantee them at least 4 years of free tuition, plus whatever other aid their individual circumstances qualify them for. And the whole idea is to get out there the message that the University of Michigan is accessible to talented students from all around the state of Michigan, regardless of their family circumstances. If you're smart, you're willing to work hard, you want to make your life better by becoming more educated, then we're the place for you.
Does a family have to prove it qualifies each year?
If the family circumstances change dramatically, it'll change. But, you know, usually there's quite a bit of stability. And it's not as if $65,000 is a magic number. It turns out we give generous aid to families up over $100,000 of income. In each instance, we look at their resources and their circumstances. So families that have multiple kids in school, we take account of that when we calculate their need. So this is need-based financial aid. And what we can assure students is if you're $65,000 or below as a family, you'll get at least free tuition.
What prompted this idea?
Well, for many years, the university has been investing at rates that are double-digit increases every year in our financial aid budget, developing the resources to make sure that a college education remains affordable regardless of a family's circumstances. However, we weren't seeing the numbers of applications we were hoping to see from folks at the median income range in the state or below. So we talk a lot about diversity at the University of Michigan. One of the important forms of diversity on our campus is socioeconomic diversity, and we'd like to increase it. And we thought that reassuring families with the word free would help them really clearly understand what the financial ability is to go ahead and attend college. We also did an experiment the last 2 years called the Hale Scholars Program, where we partnered with high schools all around the state, and we offered free tuition to students at a certain income level if they were accepted to the university. And then we took a control group, very similar students, that we said we give generous financial aid, but we didn't make them this advance offer of free tuition. And it turned out in this Hale Scholars Program, the applications we got from the group that we offered the free tuition to were 2.5-fold more applications than from the control group that we just said we give generous aid. And now we're sort of extending this concept all around the state.
Are you going to have to cap this at a certain number, or is this unlimited? Whoever qualifies gets the guarantee.
This applies to any student from a family $65,000 of income or below, and there are some exceptions to that for families that have a very small number of families that have large amounts of resources, lots and lots of money in the bank, but still have a small income, which is an unusual thing. But it's assured to all families into the indefinite future.
You know, social media is abuzz about this, but some skeptics, I'll note out-of-state skeptics, noted Ivy League schools have been doing this for a long time. The threshold is more generous. How common, though, is something like this among public universities?
Well, there are programs that are somewhat similar, but I don't know of anything just like this. So, for example, I spent many years as a faculty member at UC Berkeley. So the University of California system has something they call Cal Grants, and that's money that actually goes directly from the state of California to students that are going to go ahead and pursue their education inside the state. And that amount of money is really generous. It's over $10,000 a year to individual students who have certain academic qualifications. Here, the state of Michigan, the equivalent program provides about $700 each to students. So what's unusual about the Go Blue Guarantee is it's the university itself, a single university, a public university, that's pulling together from various sources the resources necessary to provide need-based financial aid up to this order of magnitude.
As we all know, state government contributions to public universities are not what they once were. How will you pay for the Go Blue Guarantee?
Sure. So, you know, I don't want to be ungrateful to the state, but the state of Michigan still provides us now with over $300 million a year of state support, and that's money that we can certainly use towards these goals that I'm talking about now. But we have a large endowment and very generous donors. And about 20% of our endowment is targeted towards student financial aid of the type we're talking about. So this would not be possible without the generosity of generations of University of Michigan donors, the vast majority of whom are alumni that recognize how much they benefited from their educations and want to help other students, you know, benefit as well. And there was one sort of bit of misreporting on this story that I wanted to try to clear up, but maybe it's been cleared up already. But we give financial aid to students to meet their full calculated need well above families that earn $65,000 a year. So I don't want to discourage any family that has a student that aspires to a Michigan-level education from applying. You know, we look at kids and their family circumstances one at a time, and we give very generous aid based on a person's ability to pay.
So this free tuition program, the Go Blue Guarantee, starts this year?
It applies to both current students and then future students that will accept, you know, for the class that begins a year from now. But it starts in January of 2018. So we're in the process of recalculating our financial aid for students who are already Michigan students, who starting in the spring semester, if they qualify for the program, they'll benefit from it, as well as all the freshmen we admit for the year after, for the fall of 2018.
Mark Schlissel is the president of the University of Michigan. Thanks for talking with us.
Great. Thanks for your interest.
In Detroit last week, the League of American Orchestras awarded a Grand Rapids Symphony musician with the Ford Musician Award for Excellence in Community Service. Only four of those awards are presented in the entire nation. The recipient is Diane McElfish-Helly. She's a violinist. The award was for a program she leads called the Music for Health Initiative. Diane McElfish-Helly joins us now. First, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So tell us what the Music for Health Initiative actually is.
The Music for Health Initiative is one of the ways that the symphony is able to send musicians out into the community all the time. People just think of us as an organization sometimes that does concerts on Friday and Saturday nights or concerts in schools, but they think of us on stage, and our Music for Health Initiative is when we flip things around and when we go out to other people. And in this case, it's musicians going first into the Spectrum Neuro Rehab, where we do sessions along with music therapists, people with traumatic brain injury, and then it branched out to cancer in infusion spaces, and it's just grown out from there. So it's live music with people who are in rehabilitation situations, not happy places in their life at the moment, and we're trying to make that better.
How does this help patients and those surrounding them, their support staff?
So we have 12 Grand Rapids Symphony musicians. We go along with music therapists into 50 music therapy sessions a year. So far, we're going to be expanding that. And while they're working with patients, maybe patients who've experienced traumatic brain injury from a car accident or a stroke, or maybe a dementia patient, or maybe someone undergoing these cancer treatments, while they're working with them, sometimes working with mood, sometimes working with exercises, it could be really any way they need to have rehabilitation, we're providing the music for that. And what's special about that is a music therapist will go alone most of the time, and there they are generating the music and evaluating the patient and evaluating the response and working alone. And when the Grand Rapids Symphony players come in, it's like having an amazing tool to use. And for us, it certainly is using our music in a different way.
So the music therapist would generally use a recording of a performance?
No.
Okay.
Music therapists generally use their voice or a guitar or maybe a keyboard. Most of the time they're using live music. But having to do that part and do the therapy, that's a lot of things all at once. When we come in, we're also not just being background. We're not just being like a recording. We're actively involved. We engage with the patients. We can follow along. Musicians are very good at following, especially symphony musicians, right? We follow conductors all the time.
Sure.
So if there's a patient who's trying to learn to move her arm, and maybe she's been given a drum and try to beat the drum, we can follow exactly the tempo she's able to do at first. And if she's able to increase, we can follow exactly. Or we can also kind of push her. It's like a really unique kind of chamber music. And so we'll do things in groups. So there will be a circle of patients. Usually music therapy happens one-on-one. That's most of the time. But when we come, they get groups of patients. So there's an interactive aspect that happens. And we can be part of that. And I think that's one of the things that's really lovely for musicians. So often there's the stage and there's the audience. And we love that relationship. But when we go into these more intimate therapy sessions, we have a circle. It's like we're the performer, or sometimes we're the audience. It's something that we're doing together. They get to perform for us, and we're the audience. There's laughter. There's a very human quality that is happening when music comes into a medical situation.
Now, I understand that music therapy has been around for a while, but how did you come up with this idea that you could take the orchestra to the patients? Why did you think the orchestra should start this Music for Health initiative?
Grand Rapids, perhaps people across Michigan don't know, but Grand Rapids is a major medical center. And our community leaders, probably 20 years ago, in sitting down and looking and planning for this community, very intentionally planned an infusion of something like $1 billion in the growth of medicine here. So within a block of our concert hall starts what we casually call the medical mile. And there's the Michigan State Medical School is there, the Van Andel, there's a research institute is there, 4 hospitals. All of this is going on close to us. So one of the questions we've been asking ourselves, and I think every arts institution, is about how do you serve your community? And the other question that we at the Symphony asked ourselves is, what does it mean to be a 21st century orchestra? And what we do Friday and Saturday night in the concert hall is always central, but that's when people can come to us, and they come to us to feed their spirits. They come to us to affect their moods. They come to us for that. And so now we're in a time where people want close contact with their artists. We do so much through our devices. People want something personal. So we looked at the fact that we have this huge medical sector, and we looked at the fact that we are about communicating and going out to our community where they are. And so it seemed to make perfect sense to us to make that connection.
Diane Helley is a violinist with Grand Rapids Symphony Orchestra and was presented the Ford Musician Award for Excellence in Community Service by the League of American Orchestras for the Music for Health Initiative. Again, congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to get to do this work.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we are in Grand Rapids. You've been dragging me around to little bars, and now we're in a really fancy bar.
We are. We are at Reserve Wine and Food with Rob Hanks.
Rob, you've got a drink for us. What is it?
I do. This is a new one that's coming up on our menu. It's called the Lover's Quarrel, mostly because myself and my other bartender, Megan, she really wanted to put a cocktail that had vodka in it. I was just pretty much against it. Fought her tooth and nail, and then I got bored one night, started using some stuff left over in the kitchen, and here we are.
With a vodka cocktail.
I don't want people to think that it's a vodka-focused cocktail, because it's technically a neutral thing. It's actually going to be mostly a Dolin Blanc vermouth that is infused with strawberry and rhubarb pulp that's left over from the juicing process in the kitchen. And that's going to be just hit with a touch of sugar, rhubarb bitters from Fee Brothers, Kettle One, just kind of dry it out and boost up the alcohol a little bit, and lemon juice.
Rhubarb, Michigan rhubarb?
Everything is Michigan around here. All of the produce in-house comes from within 50 miles of the restaurant.
Nice, except for the lemons, I take it.
Except for the lemons, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really excited about these Michigan strawberries. They are beautiful right now, and this is, of course, the season. Beautiful and red and luscious, so I'm really looking forward to this cocktail. So can you run us through, if somebody wanted to try to make this at home, what they'd do?
Yeah, sure. So if you don't have a juicer at home, you could also just muddle all of these together, let it sit for about a half an hour, about the prime infusion time, and then you're just going to strain it off to get all the pulp out of the Blanc vermouth, and it's going to be an ounce and a half of the Blanc vermouth with just 3/4 of an ounce of vodka, 1 full ounce of lemon juice, and then we use 2-to-1 simple syrup here. You can use 1-to-1. If you're going to use 1-to-1, use 1 full ounce of that with 3 dashes of the Fee Brothers rhubarb bitters.
And that's a fairly low-alcohol cocktail.
It is. It's something that I've really started to enjoy in the past year or so, is coming up with more lower ABV drinks, something that you can sustain throughout the entire day.
So, Rob, one of the things I think is really neat about this drink is that it embodies not only farm to glass, but farm to table to glass. I love that you're using something that's left over from the kitchen, adding it to a cocktail, and kind of completing that whole circuit.
Yeah, we try to do our best here to have the lowest impact on nature surrounding us. We try to use absolutely everything, like, possible. So before we juice lemons, we'll peel them, make oleo. After we juice them, obviously we have the juice for cocktails. Sometimes we take the pith and we dehydrate it, and then we crush it into a powder, which sometimes we use for our house-made bitters. So really, I don't like to see anything get thrown away unless there's just literally nothing left to it.
So you mentioned you're using a Blanc vermouth. I think most people have heard of dry vermouth and sweet vermouth. Can you tell us a little bit about that style?
Really, one of the biggest differences between dry and sweet vermouth is the type of sugar that you're using, whether you're going to be using cane sugar or caramel, and the quantity of that. So essentially, the biggest difference between Blanc vermouth and sweet vermouth is you're using the same amount of sugar that you'd be using for a sweet vermouth, except you're using cane sugar rather than caramel, so you're not going to get that really deep, rich flavor. This one specifically has a to me, a pretty bubblegummy kind of a flavor off of it, which is really kind of pretty, especially for the summer.
All right, I'm going to give the Lover's Quarrel a taste. That's really nice. I love vermouth in cocktails. I think people have a lot of bad associations with vermouth because of the way that it's been stored and kept over the years, but fresh vermouth is just a really delicious thing, and I love seeing it as a base for a cocktail. So you're right. It's definitely a vermouth cocktail with the vodka playing a supporting role, and the strawberry and the rhubarb is really accentuating the great flavors from the vermouth. So thanks.
Rob, appreciate mixing the drink for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Still to come, we look at why the rates for insurance plans in Obamacare are going up again.
One way or another, we're going to have to pay for the care that's delivered, and medical care is expensive.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A lot of things happening in Lansing this week. Let's look at a couple of them. Joining us, as they do most Fridays, are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and via Skype, Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. Vicki, the legislature is sending the governor a package of bills that will change retirement benefits for teachers. What's that going to mean for newly hired teachers?
It's a system that will really increase costs for local school districts and place more of the burden on the new employees by forcing them through a series of changes in the plan into a defined contribution plan. And I have no problem with the concept of what they're trying to do. It's the underlying reason they're doing it, which will again lead to failure of the system, and that is not dealing with adequately the removals of people from the system through privatization and charter schools without accounting for those losses. I want to remind the viewers and the listeners that the state retirement system is in charge of not only the school personnel, but the judges and also the state police. And neither of those programs are in trouble because they haven't had the kind of privatization problems that have been placed on the teachers or the MIPSERS plan. So the average cost is expected to go up, and most of this money will come out of the school aid fund in the classroom. The state Senate Fiscal Agency predicts that the estimated cost of this new plan to the state school aid fund and school districts will be $23.1 million this year, fiscal year 17-18, up to over $80 million in four short years. So it's not a solution to the problem. It's yet another attempt to fix the problem without actually fixing the problem.
Ken, the state's public education retirement system has $29 billion in unfunded liabilities. Of course, that's an unkept promise by elected officials, and their solution is to switch the teachers to this new defined contribution plan, a 401k-type plan. My question is, with the existing shortage of teachers, how is this going to help attract people to the profession?
Well, Lester, I'm not sure I'm in a position to answer that. I think there's a lot of excessive rhetoric on both sides of this issue. From the legislative Republican standpoint, you know, Vicki certainly raises some important issues like the charter school issue. But I think the larger issue from a legislative Republican standpoint is that these defined benefit plans just become unaffordable over time because it's just so easy to kind of, you know, defer the cost, to promise a benefit and defer the cost of that into the future.
Sure,
in the sense of creating more
debt.
And a defined contribution system, which is what they're going to, is more of a pay-as-you-go system. And from an accountability standpoint, it's probably a safer way to go. And yes, there are other defined benefit systems out there, judges, police, but basically they're kind of the exception now. If you're going to create a public retirement system today or a private retirement system, it's going to be a defined contribution system.
Let's move on to another issue this week. The Attorney General, Bill Schuette, has filed involuntary manslaughter charges against five people with involvement in the Flint water debacle. And that, of course, resulted in lead contamination and likely an increase in Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County. Vicki, the director of Michigan's Health and Human Services, a medical executive at that agency, a former Flint emergency manager, a Department of Environmental Quality drinking water official, and a Flint Water Department manager. What do you think of these charges against these people?
I think they're going to be hard to prove, but I'm glad that somebody's finally looking into the accountability of the delay and actually reporting the situation on the ground in Flint. You know, when there's a critical outbreak of a disease or a food poisoning issue, the duty of our elected Department of Health folks is to let people know as soon as possible so that we can start to take remedial action. That was not done, and that is their prime obligation and duty, to inform the residents. Whether or not the Legionella disease outbreak that occurred in Flint that spiked with the new water system change to the Detroit River away from the Detroit water system was the direct cause, it really at this point doesn't matter. They had a duty to inform the residents that since the change in the water system, there was a spike in Legionella. And that led to numerous deaths and countless sick people that was just unconscionable, aside from the lead poisoning. So I'm glad there are charges. As I said, I don't know where it's going to go, but people who serve in these roles need to be accountable and need to do their jobs.
Ken, underlying all this is a poverty-stricken city, which was hit particularly hard by revenue-sharing cuts, which eventually led to the appointment of an emergency manager. So how fair is it to single out these five people when the legislature and the governor would seem to have some responsibility here as well?
Well, Lester, I co-chaired the Flint Water Advisory Task Force, which we issued our report over a year ago. And I can't comment, and I'm not going to comment on specific charges against specific people. But as we said in that report, and I fully subscribe to this today, I and the group support all and any investigations in Flint, including the one conducted by the Attorney General, because there has to be full accountability and full justice at the end of the day. And we can't have a situation where we leave some issue on the table, meaning that, well, you should have looked at this or you should have looked at that. So without commenting on these specific charges, you know, there has to be full accountability and full justice at the end of the day.
That is Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. And we heard from Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you for keeping an eye on Lansing for us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thanks, Lester.
It looks as though health insurance costs are going up next year, a lot. How much depends on the Trump administration and Congress in part. Blue Cross plans to raise insurance rates for plans it offers through the Affordable Care Act by an average of about 27% for individuals and close to 14% for Blue Care Network plans. The Detroit News reports another insurer, Priority Health, is proposing a nearly 18% hike for individuals buying through Obamacare. But the rate hikes could be even higher, and we'll explain why in a second. Helping us to understand this is Richard Hirth. He's the Department Chair of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. According to reports, the state is asking insurers to submit two sets of proposed rates, one that factors in a cost-sharing subsidy from the government and one that does not count on those subsidies. Either way, in some cases, we're looking at double-digit percentage hikes. So let's start with a scenario where subsidies are approved. Why are health insurance costs through the Affordable Care Act going up so much?
Well, last year we saw increases in the state of about 17% on average. So the proposed increases are kind of on the same order. It was hoped that this would be sort of the year that it would stabilize in terms of premiums. The Obamacare plans had been underpriced for a number of years because insurers didn't anticipate that the risk pool would be quite as bad as it turned out to be, with a lot of younger, healthier people not buying into the system and instead paying the penalty. So it's a little bit disappointing in a sense that we've got another year of similar premium increases, but it probably reflects the uncertainties around the system. Not only the cost-sharing subsidies, but the Trump administration has to decide how much to market the enrollment. That's something that they did last year. At the end, they kind of pulled back in the marketing of open enrollment towards the end. And nationally, the enrollment was actually running slightly ahead of the prior year until the very end when the marketing support was pulled.
Crain's Detroit reports that Meridian Health Plan of Michigan plans an 8.3% rate hike if the subsidies are approved, but a 59% increase if the subsidies go away. How significant is this money for cost-sharing subsidies?
It's pretty significant, but that really is a very stunning difference. And most of the other plans have had differences of 3 to 10% between their rates with and without the cost-sharing subsidy. I think it's very wise of the state to have asked for the two sets of rates because that is one sort of very explicit uncertainty that you can then kind of sort of take out of the equation for the insurers that they know the rate's not going to have to be set not knowing whether they're going to get it. If you look at the cost-sharing subsidies overall, right now there's a lawsuit that Congress had actually filed under the Obama administration, and the Trump administration has to decide whether or not to continue defending that lawsuit. The House claimed that they did not actually authorize the payments for the cost-sharing subsidies. The problem from the insurer's perspective is it's unambiguous they're responsible for giving those subsidies. They certainly didn't think they were signing on for an unfunded mandate.
You talk about that uncertainty. Is that factor, the turmoil that's going on, having its own impact on the prices?
It absolutely is. If you look at people who are maybe have plans now or considering buying a plan for next year, they don't know what the future is going to hold in terms of their access to care. So if they have an elective procedure they've been thinking about, you know, I think I'm going to get that procedure now while I have insurance. So that certainly is a factor. In terms of cost-sharing subsidies, if you look at the overall amount of money paid, it's about $600 per person if you spread it over the whole Obamacare exchange population, those that do get the subsidies and those that don't. So that's about how much premium should go up if you just kind of do the simple math. Last year, a single premium on average was about $8,000 in Michigan. So we'd expect to see a less than 10% increase if we're just looking at the cost-sharing subsidy by itself. So that Meridian number, I'm not sure where they came up with that, but it does seem quite out of line.
I want to talk about the underlying cost here, that is actual health care costs. How are these insurance rate hikes connected to the actual cost of health care? I mean, is this a direct cost and it's reflected in our health care insurance? And if that's the problem, are we trying to treat the symptom instead of getting to the core of the problem?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that certainly goes into how it affects people who get their insurance through other sources as well. If we look at the underlying trends in health spending, they've been around 5% growth the last few years. And if you look at what Blue Cross has asked for in their small group market, it's about a 3 to 5% increase for the coming year. So that should reflect the underlying trend in health care costs. So this excess of the exchanges asking for 15, 20% instead of that 3 to 5 is probably reflecting the uncertainty in the market. Will the Trump administration enforce the mandates? Various other things that are going to maybe make it easier for somebody who's sitting on the fence saying, I'm not really that sick. You know, I'll just sit it out. Maybe I won't even have to pay this penalty.
Each year, fewer people are buying health insurance on the public exchanges, and many of those who do buy drop coverage after just a few months. This means more uncompensated care costs, that is, hospitals and doctors who don't get paid, and that means higher health care costs for everyone else because they have to pass on those costs somewhere. And it means a lot more sick people at work and in the classrooms. So it seems society is going to pay a price one way or another, and I'm wondering, is that the case or am I missing something here?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. Like you said, one way or another, we're going to have to pay for the care that's delivered. And medical care is expensive. You know, the fundamental reason for the level of premiums is the underlying cost of care. I just think that the growth from year to year is more on a 5% range than it would be on the 15 to 20% range. But the underlying cost is very high, and that obviously has to be covered if the insurers are going to stay in business.
I know some small business people who have been above that 400% level, and it's killing them to continue these costs.
Yeah,
and
those folks are paying the whole freight, no doubt about it.
And they're expecting this repeal and replace plan by the Republicans might actually offer them some relief. The president has told us that it's going to be cheaper, better, and simpler. Have we seen that at all? We've only seen the House plan so far. We don't know what the Senate's up to.
Well, I think there are kind of two political questions. There are more than two, but two big ones that I want to highlight. One is, who gets blamed for the premium increases? if we're going to blame the Democrats and, quote, failing Obamacare, that's obviously going to make anything the Republicans propose look relatively better. If, on the other hand, we blame the 2018 premium increases on the lack of support for the functioning of the exchanges, that really is laid on the Republicans' doorstep, and then the blame might be very different. Now, the other kind of big political question beyond what is in this unknown Senate bill is, if you look at the House bill, there are definitely winners and losers. People who are relatively young and relatively healthy definitely do better, and relatively high income do definitely better under the Republican plan, the AHCA, than they do under the Affordable Care Act, because the subsidies are tied to your age and not to your income or the cost of the premium. So if somebody who is relatively old, has some pre-existing conditions, especially if their income isn't very high, they could face some very substantial premium increases. So the small businessman that you mentioned, small business person might say, well, you know, I'm 40 years old, I'm relatively healthy, my family's relatively healthy, I used to not qualify for any premium subsidy. Now I'm going to get a break because I'm relatively young. Even if pre-existing conditions is kept, I'm still going to get a break because I'm relatively young, and I'm going to get that subsidy regardless of what my income is. So there definitely are winners from the AHCA relative to Obamacare.
Let's look at a couple of really quick things here. Medicaid expansion in Michigan is called Healthy Michigan. It's meant a lot more families have health insurance. In Michigan, an estimated 180,000 more people. What impact will these health insurance increases have on them?
It would really not have any direct impact on them. You can really think of the Medicaid expansion, the Healthy Michigan program, as a separate market. I believe it's about 600,000 people in the state that have coverage through that. And that is probably going to be unaffected or relatively little affected in 2018, almost regardless what happens. It could be dramatically affected as time goes on, both through the phase-out of the expansion that was part of the AHCA, and the Senate talk is about maybe doing the phase-out at a little bit slower rate but still kind of getting to the same end game, and also the limitation on federal subsidies for the Medicaid program, which is a federal and state partnership. The federal government seems to want to limit its contribution to sort of either a fixed block grant or a fixed per-patient amount.
What about people on Medicare? Some of them have these supplemental plans. Are they going to be hit by some of these increases? Can they get supplemental plans through the public exchanges?
Public exchanges do not provide supplemental plans. So that market essentially is untouched.
So Medicare people won't be bothered by this?
They won't really be affected by it.
Okay.
Right?
How about those people who get insurance through their employers? We're not part of the public exchange, but with the rates going up, that kind of scares everybody when they hear the insurance rates are going up. So are we likely to see that as well if we get insurance through our employers?
Again, through our employers, the rate increase is driven mostly by the underlying cost of medical care, and that seems to be going up certainly at faster than the general rate of inflation or faster than the general economy's growth, but more in the order of 5% a year, and I think that's what people in the employer market should expect to see.
You look in your crystal ball, do you see these subsidies being approved for this year, the cost-sharing subsidies?
That's hard to say because trying to predict the Trump administration I haven't had much success in it so far.
That's Richard Hirth. He's the chair of the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thanks for walking us through this.
Okay, you're welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered flawlessly by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.